So stop me if you have a question along the lines here. Don't wait till the end, because we can have questions at the end, but you'll often forget what the question is. And often, if you've got the question, someone else has the question too, so might as well clarify it while you can. So just as you guys are arriving, we saw you all arrive today coming from the outside. A bunch of the teachers are here, and they're just finishing their week here. And some of them have sent students to this program. And so as you guys were coming in, one of the teachers was saying, I sent two students there last year, and when it came back in the following year, asked them, so how did it go? What was it like at Perimeter? And he said, oh, it was really good. And he said, well, what did you get out of it? And he said, oh, I met this girl. so enjoy the whole program. it's a great experience being together, and you never know what's going to happen. So, what's the universe made out of? That's my title. You're going to get a talk also about the Higgs particle, I think, later on, which will be another exciting thing. And so this is something where the answer is no one has a clue. But it's kind of contradictory, because no one really has a clue of what the universe is made out of in a very precise sense. There's 96% of what's out there, no one has a clue what it is. But on the other hand, people think they have a really good understanding, or a fairly good understanding of what the universe is and what it's been doing. And that kind of sounds paradoxical, that if you really understood what was going on, how could you not know what's in it? And so the goal of this presentation is to convince you that it sounds paradoxical, but it's really true. And that even though there's good evidence for there being not just one thing we don't understand, but two things we don't understand, it's still true that we really have a robust picture of what's going on up there, and so that there's a really a fairly good case for the existence of this stuff. And it's the situation's actually similar to what it was about 100 years ago. So 100 years ago, just over, you remember there was a celebration for Einstein's big year, and he published these five papers that year. And some of them I'm sure you know. So this is the special relativity one. This is the equals mc squared one. But the one, and this is the photoelectric, this is what he got his Nobel Prize for, was the photoelectric effect. But the two that were the biggest deal at the time were these two. This is his doctoral thesis, and this is the one on the Brownian motion. And the reason those were a big deal at the time was, at the time, people were not really sure that atoms were real. And there was this theory that atoms were there, they're very small, you'll never see them, they're too small. When I was in school, they told us we'll never see atoms, and now people write IBM and atoms and things like that. But people were sure that atoms were there way before you could actually touch them or make them and see them one by one. And what was compelling about the argument for atoms was these two papers were part of that story. And what convinced people that atoms existed was not any one line of evidence. It's not enough to have some one line of evidence that says that you could understand this if there were atoms. What you need is many lines of evidence. And the fact that they all give you the same story, so there's many different ways in which you can count the number of atoms in a volume and what the mass of those atoms is. And even though they're all logically independent ways of thinking about it, they all give you the same answer. And that's what gives you confidence that the story is basically right. Not only do you learn what the atoms are like, but you learn that the picture that there are atoms is probably right too. And so the burden on me, if I'm going to convince you guys that there's dark matter or dark energy that you can't actually see yet out there, I have to give you not one line of evidence, I have to give you many lines of redundant, converging evidence that if my story had been wrong, they wouldn't have had to give you the same answer, but they do. And that consistency of that picture is kind of what makes you think that there's really something to the evidence. So here's the way I'm going to... Oh, slow down. Here's the way I want to tell you about it. I want to first tell you the story of what we know. So the hot Big Bang is the theory of why the universe... It's an observational fact that the universe is expanding, and the hot Big Bang is a theory of why it's expanding. And it's kind of more or less what it says. It says that in the past things were hot, and then you kind of say, well, let's think it's the simplest hot thing you can imagine, a bunch of elementary particles, and then if you imagine running the universe forward under that assumption, what would it look like? And then you ask, does it look like what's around you? And that's more or less what happens. And so the first three things here are the evidence for that picture. So the first piece of evidence is, how do we know the universe is expanding? And how do we know that this hot Big Bang picture of why it's expanding is right? And then that will lead you to the evidence for dark matter and dark energy. So it's the consistency of this story of the universe expanding that leads you to this evidence that ultimately leads you to the ability to count what's out there, regardless of whether you can see it or not. So then the question will be, what is this stuff? And then so the answer is no one knows, but I can tell you kind of what people think. And so for dark matter, there's a kind of a coherent story because there's roughly three lines that you can imagine approaching. And one of them is, I'm going to argue, is more likely than the other ones. But really, we don't know. And so maybe what's nice about this stuff is that, you know, maybe you guys will be the ones to solve it. Something which will probably be settled in the next 5 to 10 years. You don't really know exactly how long it'll take, but there's ongoing efforts to do it. And it's ripe for solution. Dark energy is a harder one. I think it's fair to say that there's no consensus as to what the dark energy should be. You know, I have a theory. Other people have theories. And the complaint normally people have is that none of these theories pass the ego test, that if you ask someone who likes a theory, did you make up the theory, and they all say yes. And so for dark matter, it's not like that. There's several broad ideas, and there's a consensus that these things are reasonable, and so people are trying to test them in detail. And then I'll stop, and hopefully that won't be too late in the day. What time did I start?
At about 22.
22? Okay. All right, so that's the program. So it all starts as a science with Einstein again. And he's the guy who says that, you know, he in general relativity, so 11 years after special relativity, so 1916, he's the guy who applies relativity, which is kind of how you understand how things, the properties of things moving close to the speed of light, how that applies to gravity. And the upshot of the theory is that you reinterpret gravity, instead of being a force acting between particles, you interpret it instead as being that if you have energy, anything that has energy curves the space and time around it, and then everybody's trying to move in their straightest line they can possibly can, but if they're moving in a curved space and time, then they don't move in straight lines. And so because they're moving in the straightest line they can, and how straight that line can be depends on what the curvature of space-time is, and what that curvature is depends on the particles that are around, it means that the trajectories particles take depends on what's around them, and that's what we interpret as gravity. So it's a very deep picture of what gravity is. But what's important about it for cosmology is that it's connecting geometry to energy. And although in the solar system, when you're asking how things respond to the sun or the earth, you're talking about a geometry around some specific source, once you've opened up the idea that geometry is physics and that it responds to things, if you change the masses that are there, then the geometry changes, then the geometry of the whole universe, you know, in toto is also up for grabs, and it should be a physical thing. It's something which, it's an empirical question what it is, and it's also should be related to the energy in the universe as a whole. If you knew the energy density on average everywhere in the universe, you should be able to figure out what the geometry of the universe is. Maybe it's a sphere. Maybe if you go that way far enough, you eventually come back in from this side. You know, that's something which should be an empirical question once you make gravity geometry. And so the whole story of cosmology is about measuring where the energy is and then inferring what the geometry is, and then also measuring the properties of the geometry. If you shine light around the universe, you're measuring its shape, and so you can infer what had to be in the universe from that. But the linchpin of the whole thing is this geometry and energy story that Einstein gives us. So where is stuff? You look around us, and it doesn't look very uniform. So, you know, you see stars in the sky, and all the stars you see in the sky except for almost essentially everything you see in the sky except for, you know, three things are in our galaxy. So stars tend to come in these galaxies, which are collections of stars, billions of stars, hundreds of millions and hundreds of billions of stars. And the galaxies tend to come in clusters of galaxies. And the clusters of galaxies tend to be linked together with other clusters of galaxies. And so the more you look around you, the things are clumpier. But what seems to be true is that if you go on the largest scales possible, things start to look fairly uniform. In a way, I want to show you the evidence for. So that's what galaxies look like. But now this is not a movie so much as a map. This is, people have been surveying where galaxies are. And this is the things that you're looking at as the dots here are galaxies, as you'll see when it zooms in. And it's not the photograph of the galaxy there, but it's kind of an image of a galaxy where a galaxy should have been. And it's in these funny wedges because they're surveying the sky and they're not done yet. So they look here and they look there. And so it's not that the galaxies are in wedges, but that's what they've seen so far. And so you see there's galaxies everywhere, and there are clusters, and sometimes there's more together, and sometimes there's less. There's fewer in the center, but that's just because we're in the center in this picture, and the way they're looking for them doesn't work close up. It works mostly for things that are far away. And so if you come back out again, you see that there's galaxies, and you're going to see clusters of them at various points. But it's more or less uniform once you get far enough out. Every once in a while, you see things called fingers of God over here. Those are things that are pointing at us, and that's an artifact of how they measure where these galaxies are. That tends to be what happens when you see a cluster of galaxies. They're moving, and they're inferring the position of these galaxies from their motion. And if you come outside of these galaxies, there's a set of brighter galaxies that they can also identify, and they're very uniform when you look at where they are. And as you get far enough out, eventually you get to this thing which is not white. You'll see in a second. This is taken from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. But this is now, this blue and white thing is from the WMAP survey. And what that is that if you look far enough out in the universe, it's eventually no longer transparent. So you see an end to how far light goes. And I'll come back to why that's true in a second. But it's basically that what you're looking at, that green and blue thing, is if you look the farther out you look in the universe, the older the universe was when the light left it. And when you're that far out, the universe is so hot that it was full of a gas of hydrogen, which was ionized, that the electrons and nuclei were not tied to each other. And so basically they were all charged. And what's really good about charged particles is they scatter light very efficiently. So light no longer travels in straight lines, not interacting at that point, and it becomes opaque. And what you're looking at here are sound waves in that hydrogen, which last scattered with the light about 100,000 years after the Big Bang. So some 14 billion years ago, but not long after the Big Bang formed, after the Big Bang. And I'll come back to what the Big Bang is in a second. But that's more or less a survey. And what you're supposed to get from this is that on large scales, it used to be Einstein made the assumption, the simplest assumption, that energy was distributed in a homogeneous, very smooth, even way. Now it's an experimental fact. These color changes are changes in density in the hydrogen because it's sound waves. But what's not conveyed here is the amplitude of those changes. It's one part in 100,000. So if you measured the density of the hydrogen everywhere in the sky, it's the same up to the fifth decimal place. So it's a very, very homogeneous environment the farther away you look. And that's just the fact of life as you look at where things are. So that's good. So that's where they are. Now, how are they moving? Now, since the 1920s, basically, there's been evidence that all those things you're looking at, except for about five things, the most distant thing you can see in the sky is the Andromeda Galaxy. I don't know if you guys know how to find that in the sky. You can see it with your naked eye. I don't know. Who knows how to find the Andromeda Galaxy? Because if you don't, someone here should teach you. It's not difficult to find. It's actually about the size of the moon. It's just very dim. Galaxies are not hard to see with your eye because they're small. It's because they're dim, and so that they're drowned out. Your eye doesn't catch enough light. Telescopes catch the light more than they magnify things. But essentially, all but five or a handful of galaxies out there are moving away from us. And you can measure that by measuring their speed of recession, and you measure that from the Doppler effect, that if something is moving away from you and making a sound, it makes the ambulance sound, the kind of na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na as it's moving away. And for light, it's the same story, that light that's sent to you is more red if it's coming to you from a receding object. And so by measuring the colors of galaxies, you can tell how they're moving. And so how are they moving? They're moving according to a pattern. And here's the pattern. The rule is a very simple rule. The speed with which a galaxy moves away from us, except for the ones that are very close to us, like just a handful of them, is proportional to how far away they are from us. So you take, this is distance across the bottom here, and it's in megaparsecs. So a parsec is about 3 light years. Light year is how far light goes in a year. And mega is just metric for a million, so that's like 3 million light years is the unit. And then here, this is a speed, essentially. And this is the speeds of galaxies as a function of distance. It's a nice straight line. And that says that the galaxies that are twice away, if you take a set of galaxies that are twice as far away as another set of galaxies, they're moving twice as fast from us. So that's a very simple rule. That's called Hubble's rule. The proportionality constant, speed is proportional to distance. That constant is called Hubble's constant, which I want you to remember for later on. Now, what's special about, there's two things special about that rule. First thing that's special about that rule is that every galaxy, if you were on another galaxy looking at all the galaxies around you, you would see the same rule with this rule. So that if the rule had been speed is proportional to distance cubed or something, that would not have been true. If you've been on other galaxies, you'd know there's a special place where this rule holds. But this rule is the same for all the galaxies. And the second thing that's special about that galaxy is that if you ask they're all moving away from us. At some point, they were here. When were they here? The answer is they're all here at the same time if they're not accelerating. You know, the ones that are twice as far away are going twice as fast, so if you kind of extrapolate them back, they're all here together. And that's the evidence that there was something dramatic in our past, the Big Bang. And if that's true, you would have thought that, you know, it's like a bomb went off. But if a bomb had gone off in this room and you were figuring out, if you were the CSI person trying to figure out where the bomb went off, you'd look for the hole. Where is the hole? If we look around us, if a bomb had gone off near us, we should see evidence for it. And there, I told you everything looks very smooth. So what's with that? The story with that is that the picture you should have is not that galaxies are moving away from us in space. It's that space is expanding, and all the galaxies are just sitting there in the space, and they're moving away from us because the space is expanding. So here's a picture of space, and these dots are supposed to be galaxies, and these wiggly lines are supposed to be light waves, and everything's getting bigger, so the galaxies are moving apart from one another, and the wavelengths of the light rays are getting longer, and so the bluer ones are becoming red because that's a longer wavelength. And so I had told you before that people inferred that galaxies are moving away because of the Doppler effect, but really that's a bit of a lie. A better picture of it is that the light coming from galaxies is red because in the meantime, on their way here, the universe has expanded, and so the light just got longer, the wavelength got longer, and so we receive it more red than it was emitted. But that kind of a picture, there's no special place where it blows up. When you get right back to the origin, it's not that there was a bomb at some point in space. All of space is here, and there's nothing outside of space to point to relative to where everybody was leaving from. So that's the picture. That's also what Einstein's theory predicts, that space should be expanding. And so there's good evidence that it is. And it seems to be this very simple rule where things are moving apart in this proportional to the distance. I always have a list here of things. I'm not talking about them all, because I'm trying to tell you there's lots of lines of evidence, and I'm giving you the highlights here because we only want to be here for an hour. But I have slides on them all, so if you got curious about one of them, I can show you the slides. All right, so that's the evidence for things expanding. Now, what's the Big Bang? The Big Bang says, well, in the past, things were smaller. If you make things smaller, they tend to get hotter. So things should have been hotter in the past. And so the hot Big Bang says, let's just assume that it's the simplest possible hot thing. It's a gas of elementary particles. If things were sufficiently hot, atoms would not be able to stay together, because every time they formed, they'd collide and get knocked apart. But if we think we know what the elementary particles are, so at a hot enough universe, you would have a soup of elementary particles, and you can just let that universe evolve, expand, cool down. Eventually, various things should form. Atoms should form, and nuclei should form. And we could ask, you know, what does it look like what we see? So the first question is, how would we know? So how would we know is to do with the formation of things, the bound things, typically. So this is just a graphic that's showing you that small things are hot, big things are cold, but also reminding you that what temperature really is measuring is it's measuring the energy of the average motion of things that are randomly moving. And so the speed with which they collide is higher at higher temperatures, and so the violence with which they collide is also higher. And so the difference between a high temperature gas and a low temperature gas is how what makes up a high temperature gas versus a low temperature gas depends on its temperature, because the higher the temperature you have, the more violent the collisions are, and the more you're able to knock apart things like atoms or nuclei. So for example, if you have a gas that's hotter than about 1,000 degrees, the electrons on an atom won't be able to stay on an atom, because they're always finding atoms, and they're finding nuclei, and they're making neutral atoms. But as soon as they find them, they're hit by something else and knocked apart again, because the average collisions are more energetic than the binding energy of the electron to the atom. But if you're below 1,000 degrees, that same logic is true. They find each other, but they no longer get knocked apart because the collisions are not violent enough to give you an energy that's larger than the binding energy of the atom. Same story is true for nuclei. They break up into their constituent protons and neutrons if you're above about 10 billion degrees. And what I'm about to argue is that there's evidence, experimental evidence, that the universe was once 10 billion degrees. So nuclei were actually forming at some point. And so what you would look for is evidence now that at one point, nuclei formed through a process of a cooling gas, and that atoms formed through a process of cooling gas. And so I'm going to give you that evidence. For the atoms, it's going to be that hydrogen, the opaqueness of the universe that I showed you a picture of, as you'll see in a second. All right, so how do you tell if nuclei once formed? So this is the evidence for nuclei forming. This is the evidence for atoms forming. And we'll probably won't talk about that, but it's a separate line of evidence. So if you're above 10 billion degrees, you've got a soup of protons and neutrons and electrons, and they're all running around and colliding and not forming any nuclei. But as you cool down, the protons find the neutrons, and they form deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen. And then the deuterium can find more deuterium and make helium, which is two protons and two neutrons. And so you start building up the lightest elements. Because it's a rare thing for things to collide, so things will collide two things at a time. You won't get five things coming together at once. So you don't immediately make uranium or anything. So what you expect is to get mostly light elements, but you can predict precisely what the relative abundance is of these elements because it depends on nuclear reactions, which we think we understand, and how fast the universe is expanding and so cooling off. And so this is one of those, I'm going to kind of linger on this a little bit, so stay with me. The point of this will be, I want to show you that there's the fact that you can look at the abundance of all these different nuclei is one of these pictures with as many lines of evidence that the story I'm telling you is likely to be true. So how does the story work? So this is supposed to be a plot of, across the bottom here is time. It's in seconds. This all happens in the first few minutes of the universe. So this is like the first 3 minutes is about is 180 seconds. So this is a log scale. So this is 10 seconds. This is 100 seconds. This is 1,000 seconds. And so 3 minutes is in here somewhere. And then this is the fraction of the energy density of the universe, or fraction of the atoms that are any particular kind of nucleus. So up here is zero. That means everything. This is 0.1. So this is a tenth of everything, a hundredth of everything. This is 10 to the minus 5 of everything, and so on. And you start off with essentially protons and neutrons. So H here is hydrogen nuclei, that's protons. So that's almost everything's protons if you go back early enough. And this is neutrons. It's a little bit fewer neutrons because they're a little bit heavier than protons, and so it turns out they're a little bit harder to get. And you might notice that this line is actually falling compared to this line. That's because neutrons decay into protons if they're left. And the half-life for that is a few minutes, or 13 minutes. So it's kind of comparable to the times we're talking about here. And then these other things are our nuclei. So this red one is deuterium. That's a bound state of a proton and a neutron. And so as you let things go, what happens is everybody's colliding. Every so often, a proton and a neutron find each other, and they make deuterium. And so you get more and more and more of it. And it builds up and builds up and builds up. And then it dips down. And it dips down because once you get enough deuterium, it starts to find each other, and they start to make helium. And so that's why you see this green line is helium. It starts to form once there's enough deuterium. And once you get too much helium, it depletes the deuterium. And these other things here are helium-3, that's two protons and one neutron. Hydrogen-3, tritium is three protons. Sorry, one proton and two neutrons. And then this is beryllium and so on. And so there's a definite prediction at any given time as to how much of everything you have, but then everything stops after a while. And that's because eventually the universe gets so big that it's hard for these guys to find each other. So that things have cooled to the point where it's just very rare for any two nuclei to find each other, so the reactions essentially stop. And so what I want to show you is where things stop. You see, you get lots of helium because that's a very tightly bound nucleus, and you get less of these other guys. And you still have a lot of hydrogen at the end. That's mostly what's there. And so I want to show you the relative abundance of these things at the very end, once time has gone past this epoch, as a function of how many atoms there were in the universe as a whole. You know that if there's more atoms, there'll be more collisions. And so these reactions, like making helium from deuterium, will be more efficient. So you'll get more helium. If there's fewer atoms, if there's only one atom, it doesn't find anything. If there's 10 atoms, then the likelihood of them finding each other will be more rare, more unlikely than it would be if there's lots of them. So what you get here, how things end up, the abundance of these elements, depends on the total number of atoms that are out there, regardless of whether you see them or not. And I'm telling you this story because I want to tell you later on, when you count how much dark matter there is out there, that they're not atoms. And so to tell you that, I have to be able to convince you we can count atoms, even if you can't see them. And this is one of the ways you count atoms. So the next slide I'm going to show you shows you how much helium you have as a function of how many atoms there were in total. That's what this shows. So here we have how much helium you have. This is everything's helium. This is a tenth of everything is helium. A hundredth of everything is helium. And this is the number of atoms, the density of atoms. It's B for baryons, which is how you count atoms in cosmology. And this is in funny units. One here means 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter. And this is a tenth of that and a hundredth of that and so on. And that's not a random number. That's you're going to see later on. That turns out to be the measured value, the average density of matter in the universe is about 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter. So what you see here is the amount of helium you get. This is the experimental, this is the theoretical prediction. It's a climbing function because of what I told you. The more atoms you have, the easier it is for the deuterium to find the other deuteriums, and so the more helium you get from that, because once you get a helium, it's so well bound, it just stays bound. And then this faint line you may not be able to see here is the measured value of helium, the primordial helium in the early universe. And so it agrees with this curve on a fairly wide range of numbers of atoms. But if you could figure out where these two curves agree, then you could have some idea as to how many atoms there are in the universe. So that's the helium story. It's not telling you a whole bunch because it's such a shallow curve there. But let's do the same thing now for helium-3, which is two protons and one neutron. Same story. Here's the prediction. It's a falling one because helium-3, the more atoms there are, likes to collide and make other things like helium-4. So it finds a neutron and makes helium-4. So the more reactions you have, which you have if you have more atoms, the less of this you have and the more of this you have. Here's what the measured value of helium-3 is. And so they also agree for some choice of the number of atoms in the universe. Here's the same thing for deuterium, if I can get the slide to go. Here's the prediction. Again, it gets made into other things, so it falls. Here's the measured value. Again, they agree for some range. Here's what you get for lithium-7. There's the prediction, and here's the measured range. And there's a controversy in the measurement, is why there's two colors there. And what you see is that they're all agreeing for the same value of the total number of atoms. And so that's an example of why this is probably the right picture. If these nuclei were being made by some other thing, like in stars, if we calculated their abundance in this way, we didn't have to find the same answer for the total number of atoms if this is not really where the stuff came from. But because we're getting the same answer in all these different cases, that means that probably this is where the stuff did come from, and we know how many atoms there are. It's something like 4% of the total number of energy that's out there, amount of energy that's out there, although I have to convince you later on as to why that's the total number of amount of stuff out there. But that's telling us several things. We think there's evidence that the universe once did cool and make atoms, make nuclei, and that's telling us how many atoms there were at the time. And they haven't gone anywhere, so that's still a number that is around now. All right, enough about that. What about when you form atoms? So that was the story of nuclei. What about when the electrons find the nuclei and form neutral atoms? Well, we don't have the same kind of a thing. You can't count the abundance of, you know, neutral atoms as opposed to excited atoms. There's a different argument that applies in this case, but there's still evidence that once the universe cooled down and made neutral atoms. And here's what the evidence is. I alluded to it before. Once the world is full of neutral atoms, neutral things are very bad at scattering light, because light, photons coupled to the thing that scatters photons is charged particles. You rip an atom apart into electrons and nuclei, it loves to scatter light. And so that's if you were inside the sun, you know, it would be very hot, but it would also be hard to see your hand in front of your face, because inside the sun, atoms are also, it's more than 1,000 degrees. Atoms, electrons have been stripped from the nuclei of the hydrogen that mostly the sun is made out of. And so light coming from your hand would bounce around so much that it wouldn't move in straight lines. And so it'd be like you're in a fog, a very luminous fog. But as you moved out from the center of the sun and it got cooler, eventually the atoms form, the electrons combine with the nuclei to form neutral atoms. And at that point, the sun becomes transparent, and that's the difference between the inner convective radiative zone and the outer convective zone. The physics changes because the sun becomes transparent. Now, if you were in the early universe, when it was cooling down through 1,000 degrees, when it was above 1,000 degrees, if you had your hand in front of your face, you wouldn't see it because light is bouncing around a lot. Light takes I think, 100,000 years to get out of the sun because it bounces around so much. Neutrinos take 3 seconds to get out of the sun because it's three light seconds across. So there was at one point there was a puzzle as to why when you measure the number of neutrinos coming from the sun, there were fewer than you expect, and you can count them because you know they're being emitted by the nuclear reactions that power the sun, and you know how bright the sun is. And one of the hypothetical solutions to that problem was the sun is actually turned off, because the light would take 100,000 years to tell us that it's turned off, whereas the neutrinos would stop immediately. Turns out that wasn't the solution, but it kind of underlines the fact that light really bounces around a lot in the sun, and it would have done in the early universe too. So if you're in this early universe, it's cooling down, you can't see anything. As you pass through 1,000 degrees, what happens is that the whole universe goes from being a very luminous, but luminous cloud to being transparent. It's like the cloud evaporates. But all the light that was there is still there. It just, it's no longer hitting anything. And so now it's moving in straight lines. And so you can look for it. And so, and it's been seen. And so these are the people that it's seen. It's no longer seen as visible light. When it was last emitted by the hydrogen atoms, it was visible to ultraviolet light. But in the meantime, the universe has been expanding, and so its wavelengths have been getting longer. So now it's microwaves. And when you turn your TV on, and you probably don't do this anymore, but when I was a kid, we turned our TV on and we didn't have cable, so we had rabbit ears. And when you weren't on a station, you just got this gray shh. About 40% of that is cosmic photons from the Big Bang. It's the right frequency, and there's the most abundant particles in the universe are, that we know about, are these microwave photons. There's 10 billion for every atom. So there's a lot of photons out there. They're microwaves, and so they were found. They were found by accident by these people in the 60s. These guys worked at Bell Labs in New Jersey, and they're making a microwave antenna. And so when you're testing a microwave antenna, what you do is you make it, and then you point it at something which is not going to send you any microwaves. You make sure it's working, because you shouldn't be getting anything. And then you point it at something which you think is sending microwaves, and you get what you get. So they pointed at the sky, and they could never get it to not see microwaves. And so they spent a lot of time trying to figure out what they'd done wrong with their antenna, including there's this famous line in their paper where they talk about sending a student up to remove a white dielectric material, which was basically pigeon shit in the bottom of the horn, because that changes how it would respond to microwaves. But eventually they figured out that the microwaves are really there, and it was coming from space. And so they found this light that's still there from the Big Bang. So, and ever since then, once you've seen it, you're looking at that light that last scattered from something back when the universe was passing through 1,000 degrees and becoming transparent. And so that the fact that we see it tells us that at one point the universe did that. So here's a picture of it. This is as if we're inside that sphere that you saw in the movie at the very beginning, and it's unwrapped like a globe. And so this is lots of microwaves, and this is not so much microwaves. And this is really what you're looking at here is our galaxy. We're living inside our galaxy. So people look at this, at the temperatures that you're seeing, to infer what you're seeing in space, and there's a lot of debate about what the interpretation should be. This is one of them. It's a call for help. But what this really is this is a galaxy. So you remove the galaxy by subtracting. What they really do is they measure this with several different wavelengths of microwaves, and the galaxy is not equally bright in all of them. So you, by seeing how things change as you change the wavelength, you can figure out what the galaxy is and subtract it. And then when you're done, you get this. This is the map of the primordial microwaves coming to us in all directions from this, when the universe was first cooling down through 1,000 degrees. And there's, right here, you can see there's an SH. That's SH. That's where Stephen Hawking got his initials in there. That's kind of, there's fluctuations, and it's like the face on Mars, right? You can always find something that you recognize. And so here's an SH. And that was there. That was noticed the first time 15 years ago, and it's stayed there as you measure these things. So this is looking at the universe, a snapshot of the universe when it was 100,000 years old. And it tells you a lot about the universe then. In particular, that it's very homogeneous. The difference between the hot area and the cold area is, again, 5 decimal places in. The whole thing is at 2.718 degrees Kelvin, so it's just above absolute zero. But it's 2.718, 3 here, and it's 2.8718, 3.2 here. So it's a very, very small temperature change between the bright and the cold areas. All right, so that's the story about the Big Bang. There's evidence for the Big Bang. There's evidence that we were once hot enough that nuclei formed from elementary particles, and then more evidence that later on atoms formed from those nuclei and electrons. So what's the evidence for dark matter and dark energy, since we're halfway through the talk, at least. And that's the title of the talk. So a lot of evidence. I'm not going to tell you all of them. So let me focus on a couple of them. So, you see galaxies. The trick is you want to measure what's there without looking at it, without being able to see it. And so how you do that the same way you measure the mass of the sun, basically, that by looking at how things gravitate towards the sun, you can infer what the mass of the sun had to have been to account for the orbits that you see. And so if you look at the orbits of the planets, they all satisfy Kepler's third law, that their square of their period divided by the cube of their semi-major axis is some number. But Newton tells you what the number is as a function of the mass of the sun. And so by measuring that number, Kepler was effectively weighing the sun. And that's how we figure out what the mass of objects in space are. So what you do is that you do that for galaxies as a whole. You look at how the stars orbit in the galaxy. You look at how I told you that galaxies tend to be in clusters of galaxies orbiting one another. So you see how they're moving and ask what would be the mass you'd need to make them move that way. And I want to tell you that there's many ways of doing this, and they're all going to give you the same answer, but it's not the answer that you would have gotten by counting up the stars, say. So here's a picture of a cluster of galaxies. Those are clusters in a field of stars. And so one way of measuring the mass of that is to measure the speed of these galaxies. And they all have, you can measure their radial motion the same way you measured the expansion of the universe, and they're all, in this cluster, they're all a little bit different because they're moving relative to one another. And so from that speed, you can infer what mass there is holding this cluster together. And it's something like 100 times more than the mass of the galaxies that you get by counting the stars in the galaxies, or counting the light coming from the galaxies. But another way you can measure that same mass is this. You can look at the same cluster of galaxies now with an X-ray telescope and not an optical telescope. And what you see is this, that the cluster is actually emitting X-rays, but it's not coming from any one galaxy. It's coming from actually the middle of the cluster. And what that is in order to emit X-rays are very energetic compared to visible light. You know, the sun is emitting a visible light because its temperature is the one that's optimally emitting photons with that energy. To emit X-rays, you have to be much more hot than the sun would have been. So you can figure out the temperature of the gas of hydrogen that's giving you these X-rays, but temperature is telling you the motion, the random energy of the random motion of those molecules of hydrogen, and you can figure out if they're moving that fast, how much gravity would you need to keep that from dispersing that gas? And so that gives you an idea how much mass there had to be in the cluster. And it's, again, about 100 times as much as the mass in the galaxies. Turns out there's about 10 times as much matter in this gas than there is in the galaxies. So there's much more stuff in ordinary matter there than you would have gotten by just counting galaxies. So that's kind of a warning card, you know, warning call. But you're only getting about 10 times what you see in the galaxies here. And the mass you need to hold everything together is about 100 times. So you're still missing about 10 times, a factor of 10 in the stuff that you're seeing. The mass that you need to hold this together is about 10 times more than you're seeing in the gas, which is itself 10 times more than the mass in the galaxies. Another way you measure the same mass is through gravitational lensing. So when light goes by a star, gravity bends its trajectory. So if you look at, so this is a picture of a bunch of galaxies in a cluster, and what you're looking at, you see all these kind of these arc-like things. And what those are galaxies behind the cluster whose light has come past the cluster and been bent by the gravitational field of the foreground cluster. And this kind of shows you, this is supposed to be a simulation of, the pink area is a mass distribution, and you're imagining the simulation is taking a polka dot field where the polka dots were all the same size and evenly spaced, and it's moving it behind the mass, and this is showing you what the lensing would have done to it. And you see you get these arcs if you were exactly behind a point here, you'd get a ring. And you get these arcs when these dots are coming behind the big cluster of mass. And those arcs are what you're seeing when you look at these arcs. So there's lots of places where you see gravitational lensing going on. Even out here, where you don't see the arcs, these things are all kind of a little bit elongated in one way. Here they're elongated another way. Here they're elongated in this way. What people do now is they do weak lensing, which is these little things here, not these big arcs. And by looking at how galaxies are elongated in different directions, you can figure out the mass that's in between you and the galaxies. And that's one way of measuring the masses out there. So how much do you get? You get 100 times what's in the galaxies. So you see that you're getting a bunch of consistent measurements that are all giving the same answer for how much stuff there is in these galaxies. And it's more than you see in the visible light, but it's also more than you see that can be there in atoms, because we know what the total number of atoms are out there. And there's about 10 times as much as what you would have seen. It's about a few times more than you would have seen in the gas in those clouds. Here's a different way of doing the same thing. That's what I told you so far is clusters of galaxies that are sitting there. Everything's sitting and it's not doing anything interesting. Here's a particularly interesting cluster. It's a Bullock cluster. It's this one. That's a cluster and that's a cluster. And what they're doing is they're moving away from each other. That one's going that way. That one's going that way. And you can't tell that because you can't see them move. They're too far away. But the way you know that that's happening is if you look at these galaxies with X-rays. This is where all the gas is. It's in between them. And it looks like the gas has had something happen to it. And the interpretation of this is that these galaxy clusters went through each other. And the galaxies miss each other because there's a lot of space between the galaxies. But the gas doesn't. There's more stuff in the gas than there is in the galaxy, in the stars. And so what happens is that the gas hits the other gas from the other galaxy cluster. And they make this very hot region, whereas the stars just keep on going. And so this is kind of an unusual place where you separated the gas from the stars because they collided with each other. So now you can ask, well, so where's, if I look at this using lensing of light, where is the matter going to be? If most of the matter is not what you're looking at here, so what did it do? Did it go through the collision, or did it stop with the gas? So that's what they did. They used lensing to measure where the mass is, and that's where the mass is. So the mass is staying with the stars and not with the gas. And so that points to whatever this stuff is, that's the dark stuff that we're not seeing, is not behaving like the atoms did. It's not interacting very strongly with itself or with the gas. It's just going right through it like the galaxy did. So you see that they're definitely different. All right, so I'm beating you over the head with this because I want to really have you be convinced there's lots of lines of evidence here. Here's another line of evidence. You know, where did the galaxies come from? We had this gas that was 1,000 degrees. It was emitting light for the last time. And then it cools down, but it was very homogeneous. I said it was, the temperature was the same everywhere to one part in 100,000. What happens is that it wasn't exactly homogeneous because it had this, you know, you saw that there were parts that were hotter and parts that were colder, and gravity amplifies that. If you had a little overdense region, it's got more mass, so it attracts more stuff to it, and so that becomes even more overdense. And a little underdense region, stuff falls away from it. And so things tend to clump, and this is showing you how it would clump. It clumps into these things that move together, and you get kind of filaments. And essentially, these things are what are going to become galaxies and clusters of galaxies. You get clusters of galaxies where things are overdense. And there's a kind of a slightly more NASA fancified version of that, where you start off with a microwave background. The process of gravitational collapse gives you these filaments and clumps. And then eventually, things get very dense in the middle of the clumps, and stars start to form. And then some of them blow up, and some of them make galaxies. And so eventually, you find the galaxies where these clumps were. And that's the picture of how galaxies formed. And so if that's what's going on, the properties of galaxies, where they are in space, should be related to the properties of where the microwave background is in space. So you can look for correlations like that, and you find them. So this picture has got lots of lines of evidence, but in particular for dark matter. But in particular, if you ask how much time has there been since the light last left the hydrogen and came towards us, you know, has there been time to make the galaxies? The answer is no, unless there's more out there there's stuff out there that's not just atoms that we see. So if you plot the energy density in the universe against the size of the universe, so this is basically time as the universe expands, the amount of matter in the universe falls because you've got a fixed number of atoms, and this is the energy density. So as the volume gets bigger, that fixed number of atoms is less dense because it goes like 1 over the volume. Total number of atoms divided by the volume goes like 1 over the volume. For radiation, it falls more steeply because you've got some fixed number of photons, and so they're being diluted like the matter was, but each individual photon is also redshifting, so its energy is falling because the wavelength is getting longer. So it falls faster. So in the past, there's more energy in radiation than matter, but eventually what happens is there'll be more matter than radiation. That's where we live now. Now, the thing that you need to know is, so this is the total amount of number of atoms that are out there based on what we know about nuclei forming. Now, what you need to know is that this process of making galaxies can only start when matter dominates. If the radiation dominates the universe, then things move too fast and you never actually form galaxies. So the process of forming galaxies can only start once this is a cross between the radiation is less abundant than the matter. But if all you had was atoms, that would have happened later than it would have happened if you had more stuff that you can't see that's behaving like matter. And so if you ask, how long did we have to wait for galaxies to form, it's about this long. And so there wasn't enough time if all you had was atoms. There had to be something else as well. If you ask how much, it's the same amount of stuff that you see in these clusters of galaxies. And so there's really a lot of ways of counting the dark matter, and it's all giving you the same answer. And that's why you believe it's there, even though you can't see it. And you don't know what it is. All right, so I beat you to death with that. So now what about dark energy? Because now I want to convince you that there's two things out there, neither of which you can see, but you know they're different, whatever they are, and they're not atoms. So how would you do that? So for dark energy, it's a dark matter, the evidence has been accumulating since the 1930s. For dark energy, it's been accumulating since the 1990s. So there's fewer lines of evidence. So let me give you there's three, essentially, lines of evidence. So the first line of evidence comes from testing Hubble's law. I told you that different galaxies are moving at different speeds depending on how far away they are from us, and that they were moving with a speed proportional to their distance. And so that meant that if they were not accelerating, they were all here at the same time if you ran them backwards. But they are accelerating. They're all gravitating. They're all pulling each other. So they should have been slowing down. So as they moved apart from each other, all the galaxies pull all the other galaxies. And since gravity is always attractive, it should have been true that the galaxies are slowing down as they expand, as they move apart from one another. And so it should have been true that Hubble's law shouldn't be exactly right. It should be that the farther away you look, eventually you'll see the fact that the galaxies were slowing down. And so people were trying to test that. So what they expected to do, so this is what they do is they look for things that are very distant. And here's a beautiful picture of that. This is a very distant galaxy. And this is one star. And you might have thought that this is in the foreground. You might have thought that was in our galaxy, but it's not. This star is the same distance as this galaxy is. And it's as bright as that galaxy is. And that's because it's in the process of blowing up. It's a supernova. And so a supernova is when a star implodes and it explodes. The center of it implodes, and that makes the outer part explode. And when it does that, it's as bright as the whole galaxy is. It's 100 billion times as bright as a star. So it's very easy to see across the universe. And because it's known physics that's making it explode, I'm lying to you a little bit here, you know how bright it should be. And so you can figure out how far away it is by comparing how bright it is to how bright it should have been, in the same way that you can figure out how far away a car is by comparing how bright its headlamps should have been if they had been, if you know the total amount of light coming from them, and you look at how much light you're getting from them, the difference will be the amount of light that missed you because it was going in all directions and you're only subtending some small angle at the surface of the star. So you know how far away they are. They're standard candles. They're things that you can use to infer how far away they are. And they're the same distance as the galaxy. So people looked at these things and they said, well, let's now see how they're moving. And since we can see them so far, we can test Hubble's law way out to huge distances. And this is what they expected. They expected it was going to start off being straight. But it should be bending because eventually you'll see that the galaxies are slowing down. And what they thought was that it would go up. And that might seem paradoxical because that's more speed is going up. So you might have thought if they're slowing down, why didn't it go down? And that's because when you're looking at these stars over here, you're seeing them, they're very, very far away from us. So you're seeing them as they were when the light left them. And so if they're slowing down, when the light left them, they were moving faster because you're seeing them in the past when they were still moving fast. So that's why they expected the curve to go up. And of course, the reason I'm flogging this is that when they measured it, it went down. So here's what they measured. Lots of errors there, there are error bars. But this black curve is basically what you would have expected. This is the curve going up. And you see that these two curves are not doing a very good job of describing these data points. The different color curves I'm going to explain in the next slide. But the main thing you get here is that this is, again, distance. But now it's bigger distance. This is gigaparsecs. It's a billion times 3 light years. And this is a higher speeds. And so the straight line of Hubble's law is failing, but it's not failing in the direction that they expected it to, which is counterintuitive. I sold it to you as being an inevitable consequence of gravity always being attractive. Things had to slow down, but they're speeding up. The acceleration of the universe is accelerating, not decelerating. So what are these lines here? So I must have been wrong when I said that gravity is always attractive, and I was wrong. It turns out that you can make gravity be repulsive if you can arrange for a pressure to be negative. Pressure, gravity sees both pressure and energy density. Pressure is, you know, if you had a gas of particles, the mass density in that gas would have been the E equals mc squared of the energy that's tied up in the mass of all those atoms. But the pressure would have been the energy to do with a random motion. But it's all energy. So as far as Einstein is concerned, it's all gravitating. And it turns out that the pressure gravitates more efficiently than the energy does, the mass density does. And so if you can arrange for a pressure to be negative, then you can arrange for things to expand in an accelerated way. Now, that sounds very bizarre. How could you have a negative pressure? Well, it turns out that the vacuum would have negative pressure, we know. It has negative pressure because in the vacuum, nothing happens. So its energy density has to be constant. And so as the universe expands, energy density has to be constant, not the energy has to be constant. Your energy being constant is that's old news. The energy density has to be constant. But if the universe is expanding, you're getting energy from something if the density is constant. And then what you're getting energy from is the negative pressure of the vacuum does work on as the universe expands. And so we know that the vacuum, if it has any energy density, has to have a negative pressure. And that would be something which could make the universe expand in an accelerated way. So what I'm going to show you is you can infer how much. So something has to be out there, which is not dark matter, but it has to have something like negative pressure, which would make the universe accelerate in its expansion in a way that dark matter would not, because dark matter is like ordinary matter. It gravitates in the ordinary way. And I want to quantify how much you would need. So that's what the next slide will show you. So next slide. This is what you just saw. And I want to now talk about what these curves are here. So this is a plot of the amount of dark matter against the amount of vacuum energy. And again, I'm using units which are funny. And one here means, again, 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter squared. And that's the same units here. And these various dots are various choices for the amounts of dark matter. So these are two choices which have different amounts of dark matter, but no dark energy or no vacuum energy. And these are three choices which have different mixtures of dark matter and dark energy, which is vacuum energy. And what these show you is how the universe would have expanded with these five choices. And so the ones that we're doing a really bad job of describing what you see are these ones with nothing but dark matter. And the ones that do a better job are up here. And those are these curves here. And if you kind of ask statistically what's the best fit to these data points, it says you want to really live inside this ellipse somewhere. That's the kind of combination of dark matter and something else, we'll call it dark energy for lack of anything else, that these measurements are pointing to. That's one line of evidence for something that's not dark matter and not ordinary matter. Second line of evidence comes from the microwave background. The microwave background allows us to measure the geometry of space. You're looking at this, and it's at the other side of the universe from you. So light came through the universe from it, and you can figure out whether or not the universe in between is flat or curved by looking in detail at the properties of the hot and the cold regions. So I'm going to show you. It's a simple reason why you can do that, but NASA tries to give you a movie for it. I'll show you. So the key thing to focus on is how far apart the hot and the cold regions are from each other. What you're looking at there is sound wave and hydrogen. We know everything there is to know about hydrogen, and we know what the wavelength of sound is. We know how far sound could have traveled in 100,000 years, and so we know how big that physical distance is from there to there. It's like a ruler on the other side of the universe. So what you do with that ruler is you make triangles out of it. You measure the angle between the hot area and the cold area. You know the distance between them because that's a sound wave traveling in the distance that it had available to itself. And then you know how far away it is if you know how big the universe is, which you do if you've measured Hubble's constant, the proportionality in the Hubble law. And so that gives you a triangle. You know the sides of the triangle and you know the angle, so you overdetermine the whole thing. And so you can tell if it makes sense to be a triangle. So in particular, if space had been a sphere rather than flat, these things would have been farther apart from each other. If it had been a hyperbola rather than flat, they would have been closer together. And so by looking at these and comparing them to the properties of hydrogen, you can figure out where we live. We've got this ruler, which is how far sound could have gone at that time. We've got this other ruler, which is how big the universe is, which the Hubble scale tells us. And we measure this angle here. And then you know too much information there to know what if it's a triangle. So if those three numbers didn't have to agree with each other, if we weren't living in flat space, the angles would have been bigger in a sphere, would have been smaller in a hyperbola. And the measurements are giving us essentially this situation. So we know the universe is flat. So we know how much stuff is in it. So this is the way they show you. This is, again, the same thing. How much vacuum energy, how much dark matter. This is showing you. This is what you would expect if the universe had been flat. This is what you would expect if it's a sphere of different radii. This is the hyperbola case. And this is what you get from the microwave background for different assumptions for what the Hubble constant is. So if the Hubble constant, which is this thing in the Hubble law, were 40 kilometers per second per megaparsec, then you would get something down here. If it was 90, you'd get something up here. 70 is here. And it turns out that the measurements for the Hubble scale that you get by measuring the straight line for the expansion of the universe is 70. So that means that the flatness of the universe tells us we want to live here, which is kind of a specific abundance of vacuum energy compared to dark matter. And that agrees well with what we got from the acceleration of the universe. So those are consistent with each other. But we have other ways of measuring the amount of dark matter. I spent the first half of the talk telling you, 15 different ways of doing that, and that gives you this. And so these three things are all converging at that same place. And so that's basically why people believe there's two things out there, is that there's several, there's many ways of getting a hold of how much dark matter there is. There's several ways of getting hold. We know that there's something else besides dark matter because the universe is accelerating in its expansion. And there's several ways of getting at what its abundance is. And that's and they all give you this consistent picture where you've got about 75% of what's out there is vacuum energy. About 25% of what's out there is dark matter. I guess it's more like 70%. Depends on how you slice it up. And about 4% is the atoms, which is also what the formation of nuclei gives you. So it's a very consistent picture. The surprise is that the most of what's out there is not what you thought was things were made out of. So all the atoms are here. This is the dark energy. This is the dark matter. So I think as physicists, we can give this to the chemists. And our job is to figure this stuff out. And so that's completely an open book. And no one knows any day, has any idea what it is. But so people think about it a lot. And I can see that I've run my hour. So what I'll do is I'll just telegraphically say what people know about dark matter because they know a little bit about that. I won't say anything about dark energy because essentially the short version is no one knows what dark energy is. It could be the vacuum energy, but there's a reason why that's actually not a very... The experiments would be completely consistent with it being the energy of the vacuum, but there's reasons why people don't like that explanation either, which if someone asks, I can tell you, but I won't say it otherwise. So what's the story with dark matter? The three options are, maybe we were just wrong. It's ordinary atoms. It's like the dust bunnies under the bed theory. And basically the reason, there's many ways to cross that one off. One of them was nucleosynthesis. Maybe we'd inferred the existence of these things, assuming that gravity was understood by Einstein. Maybe that was wrong. Maybe it's more efficient to not have two different new things, but just to modify gravity in one way. That might be more efficient. That sounds very attractive. And maybe it's a new kind of stuff that we don't know about, some other elementary particles we've never seen. And so no one knows which of these is right, but I want to give you kind of a scorecard as if you had to make a bet right now, how I would bet. So this one, I've given you already reasons why that people don't think this is what's going on. But here's another one. If you think that you might have thought that the dark matter in our galaxy could have been planets or something, which are very dark. And there's various, you can ask how many planets form, and you can ask, you can get a handle on the number of planets in many ways, but you can also just look for them. The way you look for them is, if they were there, every once in a while they'd go in front of a star that's further away from you, and you could tell because the light going by the planet would bend. It wouldn't bend by enough to see the bending of the light, but what would happen is that you would see it for a short time twice because the light on both sides would bend, and so the star would appear to get brighter as the planet went in front of it. This is what would happen if there were two planets that were, or a star and a planet. You'd see the light would get brighter, then it would get brighter again. And so by measuring what happens, you can kind of figure out that a star has passed behind something dark. Now this is like a 1 in a million shot. You think, how often is that going to happen? You get a planet in front of a star. Well, this is actually a measurement. They've actually seen not only it happen with an individual planet, they've seen an orbiting pair have passed in front of a star. And the reason they got that was this is computers in your life, everyday life. If it's a 1 in a million shot, then what you do is you automate the process where a telescope takes a picture of a million stars every night, and it does that for 3 years, and then eventually this is going to happen a couple times. And so it's happened, 30 or 40 times. And so they've seen it happen. And of course, what also happens is that sometimes the stars get brighter on their own. So they do the same measurement in several wavelengths of light, because when a star gets brighter, it doesn't get equally bright in different wavelengths. Whereas if something goes in front of it, all the wavelengths go the same way. So they found a whole bunch of variable stars. They actually saw, hundreds of times stars get brighter, but only about 30 of them were planets passing in front of, or dim stars passing in front of other stars. So you can count them, and you do this you look at stars in the middle of our galaxy, or you look at stars in the next galaxy over, the Large Magellanic Cloud. And so you can count the amount of dark matter you would have had. If this was a dark matter, you know how massive they are, because that tells you how much lensing you get. You know how abundant they are, because you know how often it happens. And it's not enough to be the dark matter. So there's many different ways of slicing the onion and deciding that what's dark out there is not ordinary stuff. This is actually not superficially attractive, but on close inspection, it doesn't work. You can modify the laws of gravity to account for the way gravities rotate. That's actually very successful. But that same law doesn't explain clusters of galaxies or how long it takes galaxies to form. And so there's no known ways of modifying the laws of gravity that gets all the evidence right. You can get some of the evidence right, but one of the reasons why it's good to have lots of evidence is that it's hard to theoretically describe it all. It's also very difficult to modify gravity. There's fundamental reasons why what we know about relativity and quantum mechanics makes it difficult to modify gravity in long distances. So for whatever reason, although this is superficially attractive, nobody's been able to make it work. And it's not for lack of people trying, because if you could successfully do this, 100 years from now, they celebrate your special year where you wrote the paper of the new law of gravity. And so it's been really difficult to do. But this is easy. A new kind of a particle, like the particles we know about, if only it were all the particles we know, except for a few like the electron, are unstable, they decay. But if you had one particle that was like another particle we already know about, and it only were stable for some reason, it would be dark matter for free. Because you could calculate its abundance through the same process of the universe cooling. And so every graduate student in particle physics every Monday makes a new theory of dark matter this way, because it's really easy to do. And so, and when you do it, you get all of the evidence right, because all you're doing is you're getting an abundance of stuff which has the properties of matter. It's just dark because you don't see it. But it behaves gravitationally the way that dark matter would have done. So if you had to bet money, this is probably what's going on, because it's easy to do. We expect those kind of particles to exist anyway for other reasons. And it's not really a stretch, whereas nothing else really works. So if you had to bet money, that's what's going on. But the way to test it is to look for those particles. So there's lots of, you'll probably hear about experiments that are looking for these kind of particles. And if you see them, that'll be big news, because that'll be confirming what was probably true, but no one really knew in detail if this is what's going on. And it would tell you a lot about their physical properties if you could actually see them. So let me skip through dark energy, which is basically no one knows what's going on, and summarize. So three messages. One is, there's been a lot of measurements that have gone on over the last 20 years in cosmology, and the picture of the Big Bang has been tested in many, many redundant ways. And there's several ways of getting at the various parameters in the theory. There's maybe six parameters in the theory, way more than six things you can measure. They all give you the same picture of what these parameters are. So people really think they have a handle on what the universe was doing back until it was 10 billion degrees at least, because there we experimentally have evidence that nuclei once formed. You get the abundances right of the nuclei that you see. All hangs together really well. So the picture looks right, but it only works if there's, since you have enough information, you can actually count how much stuff there is out there. The universe is flat. So the universe at a given time is flat. Space-time is not flat, but the slice of space at a given time is flat. And so when you look along light rays to the other side of the universe, triangles are formed in the way all the angles add up to 180 degrees like they're supposed to. And so Einstein tells you that if you know the curvature of space as a whole, you know the total energy density in space. And there's other ways to measure it by looking at how things gravitate. And they all say the same thing. There's 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter of stuff out there. But only 4% of that can be things that we know about. And what's left has to be two things, because some things gravitate in a normal way, and other things make the universe accelerate. So there's two things that have to be there if this picture works, and it seems to work really well. So even though it seems shocking to have two things you don't understand in a theory that you understand so well, it seems to be true. What they are is anyone's guess. Dark matter, if you had to make a bet now, I would bet on elementary particles, because it's easy to do. It fits all the evidence, and no other proposals fit all the evidence. The modifying gravity one is always seductive. Everybody looks at it and says, that's got to be right, because that's only one thing rather than two things. But it turns out that it's very difficult to make modified gravity in a sensible way. We know a lot about gravity, and it turns out that it's a harder row to hoe than you might have thought. Dark energy is up for grabs. Maybe you guys will get it. I'm hoping you get it first, but if you took a poll, I think most people in theoretical physics would tell you that this is there's many ways in which you can have an unsolved problem. For dark matter, what dark matter is an unsolved problem, but there's a whole bunch of proposals that would be reasonable. For dark energy, no one can agree that there's a reasonable proposal yet. So it's a much, much more difficult problem to, at least the way we understand things now, to understand. But the way to test all these things is through observations, and there's a whole bunch of experiments that are being done now that are cutting into the parameter space that for dark matter, checking what its properties would be. Also, proposals are being made, being carried out, which measure the properties of dark energy, but they're less, they've done less because there's been less time to do it. And if I had to bet money, I'd say that in the next 10 years, we're going to know at least what the dark matter is. I think I know what the dark energy is already, but you won't all agree with me probably for another 10 years. And so that's the time frame, which is probably the time frame for you guys if you're to contribute to. So that's a good place to stop. So thank you, and sorry for running a little bit late.
Okay, if there's some time for questions, fire away.
Yeah.
Could you briefly explain why the laws of gravity cannot be altered to explain why dark matter exists? That was the second point that you explained after ordinary particles.
There's two levels of one is you just try. If you say, what would I need to do? And so there's no proposal. If you just kind of forget about anything beautiful, you just say, well, what would work? There's no proposals that get all the evidence. So the best proposal that's been made is that one of the things I did not talk about was the evidence for dark matter in galaxies. And they're all rotating. And what you do is you measure the speed with which they're rotating and as a function of how far they are from the center of the galaxy. And what happens is that whereas you would have expected from the given visible distribution that the speed should fall off with distance, what they do is they stay constant as you move away from the galaxy. And that's the sign that there's stuff out there that you're not seeing. And if you ask kind of what would you need to how would you have to modify gravity to get that right? It turns out there is a way to modify gravity that would get that right. And it's kind of counter. You might have thought that what you do is you have some new force or something. And that new force has a range. And if you're outside that range, something new happens. And that actually is a bad description, because galaxies come with different sizes. If you take big galaxies and small galaxies, there's a range of sizes which covers like a factor of 1,000 or something. And where the dark matter starts, where the speed of the stars starts to look funny, is not always at the same place. It's a different place depending on how big the galaxy is. So it turns out that what describes that well is if you manage to change gravity in a way that wasn't happening at a fixed distance, it was happening at a fixed acceleration. So if you said that maybe F equals ma only works if accelerations are bigger than a certain amount, then if they're smaller than that, then something else, maybe it's F equals ma squared or something, or some other law, then you can make the galaxies. And actually, that's a very successful description of the galaxies. But then now you go to the clusters of galaxies, and you ask what happens there. They're accelerating more than the galaxies were, so they should be in the normal. If you make it work for the galaxies, you predict that the clusters of galaxies are not seeing the new change in your law because they're in the regime where ordinary gravity would have worked. And so that proposal has to have something else to make the clusters of galaxies work. And then if you ask what cosmology, what makes the clusters form in the first place, that doesn't work. And if you ask how light bends, that doesn't work. So there's no one proposal that gets them all right, except for more stuff out there like particles that you're just not seeing. That gets it all right. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is that we actually know a lot about why general relativity it works. It turns out that this is something which might sound hokey, but it's true. So we actually now understand, electromagnetism is described by Maxwell's theory. He unified electricity and magnetism. And then Einstein's theory describes gravity. And we understand now that we have the pillars on which we build our theories now are relativity and quantum mechanics, basically. And they're almost inconsistent with each other, it turns out, for reasons that I could say if you want. But given that they're almost inconsistent with each other, it's very difficult to get theories in which they both work. And in particular, what we know is that if you have a force between charges, like electromagnetism, and any kind of a force like that, has to be described by Maxwell's equations because of the consistency of relativity and quantum mechanics. So no one's expecting Maxwell's equations to fail, even though we haven't tested them outside the distances that are much shorter than the whole universe as a whole. We're not expecting them to fail because we actually have a very deep understanding as to why they work. And gravity is the same way. If you have anything that is describing the attraction of mass or energy, it pretty much has to be described at low energies by general relativity if you want relativity and quantum mechanics to be consistent with each other. So that doesn't mean that it's impossible. It means that within our understanding of how those things hang together, no one knows how to do it, but it might be that there's some way we haven't thought of that makes it all work. But those two obstructions have made it difficult to find theories that work. So the statement is that there is no theory that gets it all right, except for the picture that it's just particles. That works. That's consistent with all the laws of nature we know. It's consistent with relativity and quantum mechanics, and it does a good job of describing what you see. So it just smells right. It's easy to do. Doesn't mean it is right, but it's until you test it. But if you had to bet, there's no really compelling alternative to it. And it's not for lack of looking. People have tried a lot of things to see if they can get around these issues.
Thank you.
I think everybody wants a drink. Yeah?
Has anybody ever found any significant dark matter interactions with other things, or is it just adding mass, invisible mass to galaxies closer to the galaxy?
Well, there's, you know, every 2 years there's a claim that someone's seen dark matter. And there's two classes of ways that they look for it. And that's because people are looking. And so what happens is that as they have a new experiment which has got, can see things that haven't been seen before, there's always something on the borderline of their errors, which could have been dark matter. And so over the last 15 years, there's been a lot of claims for dark matter. All but a few of them have gone away. And the ones that haven't gone away are kind of in limbo because people haven't been able to check them. But so what they either look for, on Earth they have a detector where they look for a dark matter particle to come through and hit something and then screw something you'd see. Or they look if the dark matter particle, for instance, supposing it were true that the dark matter particles had a reaction where if one met its antiparticle and annihilated it, it's something you could see like light, then you could look for light in various, you know, in the galaxy, say. And there are satellites now looking for gamma rays coming from the middle of the galaxy or from the next galaxy over. And recently, in the last year, a couple of years ago, they thought they were getting more gamma rays than they should have gotten from the middle of the galaxy, where you would expect most of the dark matter to be, or a lot of dark matter to be. And but when better measurements were made, it was, what's hard in astrophysics is you can't tell, you can't control what the source is. And so what's being seen could be consistent with just neutron stars, or some ordinary astrophysics could be making those photons. It could also be dark matter. But when you look at the details of how much dark matter you'd need, it doesn't quite work out. If you take the abundance, the properties that dark matter would have to have the abundance that you see, and ask, what does that say for how likely it would be for them to annihilate, you get the wrong answer. So you can kind of make a theory which fixes that, but it kind of looks funny when you do it. So right now I would say that there's two or three kind of question mark pieces of evidence which could be pointing towards dark matter being out there, but for which there's not really a compelling argument either way. So people are testing them. So there's a number of things like that, but nothing really compelling. Which makes it interesting, because every 6 months or so, another experiment comes online, and then you learn something new, and it rules out some things, and it might appear to see something else. And so it kind of focuses you in as to what you would have to do to get it, if it really was dark matter. That's the nature of science. There's a lot of ambulances to chase, but almost all of them aren't true. Yeah.
So, in your explanation of Hubble's law, velocity is proportional to distance of the galaxy away, and then you show the experimental data which disagrees with that because of a negative pressure or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
So then, why is it assumed that Hubble's law is true for matching for a flat universal space geometry if it didn't agree with that experimental data?
No, so the statement about Hubble's law, where Hubble's law comes into that is that for that triangle, you know, you got the, do you have any chalk here? Yeah. In that triangle, you're looking at kind of this distance that sound could have traveled across the universe. You're here, you know, looking at it, and you see the hot area and the cold area, and you measure that angle. So you measure that angle, you know this distance. You need to know this distance to make the whole thing redundant and to know that you're in flat space. So you have to know how big the universe is. And so the thing is that if you know the Hubble constant, then you can, from Einstein's equations, figure out how the universe expanded and how big it would have been. And so it's not just that you're not just using the Hubble scale, assuming that everything that you're looking at is satisfying Hubble's law. You're using the Hubble's law for the nearest galaxies that you measure to infer how fast the universe was expanding, and so how big it is now.
So you're saying that if you ignored that pressure thing, it's sort of... assuming that the law were true and that you didn't see that effect, this is how geometry is affected?
Yeah, because there's two things. The thing about the pressure was that when you measure the speed versus the distance, it starts off being straight, and then it only stays straight if nobody accelerates. So as long as everyone's moving at constant speed, it stays straight. But if things start to accelerate, and as they should be doing because gravity exists, then what people thought it was going to do was going to go up. But the question is at large distances, is it still straight? And that's something which is just directly measuring whether the universal expansion was accelerating or decelerating. And then this argument is a separate argument where it's arguing we know the geometry of space at a given time. And it's saying that what they really do is that they would say that You know, if you tell me the Hubble, if you tell me the what the slope is down here,
okay.
I can tell you how the universe is expanding, and
but
I can tell
short
you.
Distance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then I can tell how the universe would have expanded over a long period of time, and so how big the universe would have become since this light was emitted, and that's telling you what this distance is that you need. You need to.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Could you go back over that negative pressure concept?
Yeah, it's a weird one. You know, you should all not believe me when I say it, even though it's true. So the statement is that so if you plot the energy of the universe, the energy density in the universe against the size of the universe, and it's a logarithmic plot, say, so that each tick is a factor of 10 larger, say. Then you remember radiation was so matter, the matter density of atoms, say, it's proportional to 1 over the size cubed, because that just says there's a fixed number of atoms, and then the density goes like 1 over volume. And the volume is the size of the universe cubed. So, and then on a log plot, log of rho would be -3 log of A, so it's a straight line in this kind of a plot. So now if you did the same thing for radiation, what happens is it falls like that, and so radiation goes like 1 over the size to the fourth power, because that's really 1 over A cubed is this again, some fixed number of photons is being diluted as the universe expands. And the extra 1 over size of the universe is because each photon's energy is falling because its wavelength is getting longer. So it's being redshifted. So it falls faster and it's steeper because it's 4 rather than 3. If you did the same thing for the vacuum has got nothing in it, right? So it's essentially the vacuum energy does this. So it doesn't depend on how big the universe is. And that's weird because this is a density. So you could say, well, how can energy conservation work if that's true? And so the way that works is that the total energy in the vacuum, one way of thinking about it is that the rate of change of the total energy in the vacuum would be the energy of the vacuum times the volume. That's the total energy. So the rate of that, the change of that, should be the work done as the universe expanded. So the work done would be the pressure, which is essentially the force, and what distance it moved through as the universe expanded. So that would have been something like there's a sign I'm going to get wrong here. So I want this to be growing. So I want it to be positive. So I want this to be probably pressure times change in A PdV. So Einstein's equations give you an equation like this, but kind of the physical interpretation of it would be that the change in the energy is corresponding to the work done by the pressure. And if I'd done this right, then it might be a minus sign here. If I'd done it right, then this could be a constant, and so the energy is changing because the density was constant. But the way you get away with that is that normally if you expanded a cylinder, a volume, things would have cooled because you're taking energy out of the system through the expansion, and so the energy would have come down, but the energy can go up if your pressure had been negative. So the work that you do as you expand is not taking energy out, it's putting energy in. And that's consistent with the energy density being constant. So the energy is growing. You can either think of it as being it's the work done by the negative pressure, or it's the constant energy density filling a bigger universe. So I don't know if you buy that. So if you didn't buy that, there's another argument which says that that energy and pressure are related to one another by special relativity, and we know that the vacuum is Lorentz invariant. So that if you can't measure your motions with a vacuum, and that imposes a relationship between the pressure and the energy, and it says so the special relativity for the vacuum says that the pressure of the vacuum has to be minus its energy, with probably some C squares in there somewhere. I use units where C is 1. So that's the fact that the vacuum is Lorentz invariant tells us that its pressure has to be negative. So you want it to be negative to have a constant energy density, but the Lorentz invariant says that it is, so special relativity says it is negative, and it's negative in exactly the way it would have to be to have the energy density be constant. So that's that doesn't mean there's any evidence for it experimentally, but theoretically, if the vacuum has energy, it has to also have negative pressure because we measure it to be, because we can't measure our motion through it.
Okay.
So it's kind of a, No one knows that the vacuum energy is there, but if it were there, it would be doing the right thing. That's kind of the reason people don't believe this is the solution for dark energy is that we think we can calculate the energy of the vacuum. And it's and quantum mechanics says that there's a zero point energy for everything, and it's huge. Compared to what they measure here is way smaller than any energy you would have gotten from particles we know about. So the problem that we have theoretically with the vacuum energy being the solution to the dark energy problem is that we think that the vacuum energy should have been enormous compared to what they're actually measuring it to be. And no one knows how to make the vacuum energy small compared to what's measured rather than. So even before they found it, people already knew there was a problem. Why should it be zero, given that we think we can calculate it? So there's something that's not working in our theoretical understanding of the vacuum energy. But if you did have a vacuum energy, it would do the right thing because of the dark. That's kind of where we stand.
Thank you.
I think people are looking at you.
I had another question, actually. So is there another, what are some of the factors that can contribute to the dark energy? So the vacuum energy is one. The zero-point motion is one.
Yeah.
And that's like really big, which is actually not sure.
Right.
Are there other things that contribute to it, that could contribute to it potentially?
Lots of things could do. So there's a list of theories as long as your arm as to how, you know, there's theories where people will give you a designer vacuum energy which does all kinds of things, and you can do that in a way which is not crazy. And then it's not a vacuum energy, it's something else. But the problem they all have, the theoretical problem they all share, is that on top of that, there should have also been a vacuum energy. And if it's supposed to be huge, it'll overwhelm anything you do here. So you can do your designer thing, but the question is, why didn't you also have this huge vacuum energy, which we don't know why it's small? So the real problem is not, the experiments are actually consistent with it being constant, but the errors are quite big, so there's lots of room for you to do things like this. So the main constraints on these theories are not coming from the cosmological observations. The real problem is that all our physical theories predict a huge vacuum energy, and you have to get rid of that before you can see anything like this. So this is why they don't pass the ego test. Everybody has their own theory, and nobody convinces anybody else because they don't solve this problem. This is the problem I think I've solved, but I haven't convinced anyone else. So that's the problem you always have, right? So,
anyway. Super. Well, let's thank.